Welcome to So You Want to Be a Copywriter, brought to you by the Australian Writers Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses. Your host is Bernadette Schwert, who you'll find at copyschool.com, and you can find out more about all our copywriting courses at copywritingcourses.com.au. Now, over to Bernadette.
Greg Baker is a lecturer at Macquarie University in computational linguistics. Well, what does that really mean? Well, it means he's an expert on the topic of artificial intelligence and language, which makes him the perfect person to talk about the exciting developments in ChatGPT, and in particular, why copywriters are perfectly positioned to take advantage of all the exciting developments that AI has in store for us. One of the questions I started with was, will ChatGPT make copywriters redundant? Listen in to get the answer. I think you'll be very pleasantly surprised. Hello, I'm Bernadette Schwert, and this is a podcast for those looking to reinvent their lives as a copywriter and want some inspiration and practical tips on how to do it. I'm the founder of the Australian School of Copywriting and the head copywriting tutor at the Australian Writers Centre. If you'd like to build a side hustle, work from wherever you want, check out our courses and discover how copywriting can help you find the independence and freedom you seek. Here's a review from Gordana, who recently completed our course. She said, "The course content of videos and handouts were outstanding. The tutor feedback was really valuable. I came away with more confidence and enthusiasm to pursue copywriting as a side hustle. The course was informative, insightful, and fun. I thoroughly enjoyed the learning experience and the challenge." Well, thank you, Gordana, and I'm glad you enjoyed the course. If you'd like to make money from writing words, check out the courses that give you the confidence, the tools, and the templates to become a highly paid copywriter. You can find out all about our courses at writercentre.com.au/essentials or copyschool.com. And if you like our podcasts, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Let's get started. Greg Baker, so lovely to have you on my podcast.
Thank you, Mirach. I'm very pleased to be here.
Now, Greg, you are a lecturer in computational linguistics. I can barely say that. Can you potentially explain what that actually is for our listeners?
It's artificial intelligence for text. So it's all this business of I need the computer to go and analyze language or generate language or do interesting things with language.
And when I was thinking about ChatGPT, which of course is on, you know, a lot of people's lips at the moment, you're the first person I thought of because, you know, who knows more about it than you do? And you've got such a broad background in writing and lecturing, course creation, AI, machine learning, vision learning. You know, there's so much that you do. I thought you're the perfect person to talk to because you can speak to the technology, but also usage, but also the future as well. So that's why I've asked you along.
I'm very glad to hear that. I thought you were saying that when you thought of ChatGPT, you thought of me because I just generate robotic text.
And that is not what you're doing because your books are much better than that. But let's talk about how you use ChatGPT or AI-generated text in, let's say, the creation of your course material for both Macquarie and General Assembly, where you lecture.
One of the approaches I've taken is, obviously, I know the material. I know what it is I want to talk about, but just getting that idea of a structure. So let's say I'm launching a new course. I might ask ChatGPT to create, say, what are the sort of top six lessons I should create? And then for each of those lessons, I'll dive into one and say, okay, well, lesson one on, say, Unicode and how text is actually written down in Chinese or Russian or whatever. Okay, well, let's dive into that. What sort of topics should I cover there? And then I might add a few more and then say, well, is there anything else I've missed? And use GPT-like technologies to sort of fill in what would be normal to expect in these kind of things. And then depending on how lazy I'm feeling, like I might ask it to generate five really simple quiz questions for students because they kind of tend to be automatic and they're easy to generate. So.
And in terms of the copywriting, you know, the audience that it might be listening today, they're probably thinking, this is a really scary technology. You know, this is going to put me out of business. This is going to make me obsolete. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that in terms of the technologies in the past and what this current technology means in terms of the where we stand in the current environment.
We've been here before many, many times. So this whole, oh my gosh, I'm not going to have any work anymore. Some of us are old enough to remember when desktop computers came in and word processors, and that was going to have the same effect then. If you're really old, you might remember that people said the same kind of things about typewriters, that suddenly, you know, the amount of wordage that was possible to produce in a unit of time had suddenly increased dramatically. And even that isn't the earliest. Looking back through history, we see things like the introduction of the metal-tipped pen, because prior to that, you were either using goose feather or you were cutting your own pen by like slicing away with a pen knife, that being, of course, the origin of a pen knife, to produce something that was really kind of fragile, that would break all the time. So steel-tipped pens, suddenly you could literally write twice as much as you could before, because you didn't have to waste all this time. And then fountain pens, you know, if people of a certain age, who you may have some listeners in this space, might remember dipping their pen into the inkwell at the top of the desk. My grandmother reported to me that because she had long hair, the boys behind her would dip her hair into the ink and then sometimes write with her hair.
A very early form of bullying, I
Very
imagine.
Early form of bullying, yes.
Or inkbrush painting or something like that.
Inkbrush painting too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of these, at all of these stages, we've had this panic that suddenly writing is now going to be so easy and there's going to be so many people writing that the job of a dedicated professional scribe or writer or copywriter or ticket writer, whatever the job title was at the particular time, would disappear. And they were sort of right, but they're sort of not right, in that it doesn't actually change the need for people to do the writing. The job title might change and the job role might change, but still fundamentally there are people who are good with words and we still need them to do what they do.
So what do you think the future is? What do we need to be cognizant of?
So I've put together a framework, because, you know, being an academic, I can go and study anything I really, really want to think about this question of, in these past sort of epoch changes of how we write and production of writing, what are the common trends that we see? What are the current changes that have occurred? So I've come up with an acronym called WAVE, and I actually genuinely did come up with this acronym rather than deferring off to ChatGPT, which I often do for my lessons when I need to come up with some nice acronym. So the WAVE model is the workflow changes, particularly in terms of the automation, the adjacencies change, the volume changes, and in this generation particularly, we're going to see entrepreneurship change. So I'll go through each of those one by one. Yep.
Right. Perfect.
So workflow change. Let me try and predict the future here. The change that we're going to see is, instead of I commission you to write a piece of work and right, thank you, it's done, I'll probably be commissioning you to write some prompts that I can then automatically adapt into different areas. So for example, prepare me, say, a couple of hundred words of context so that I can append on a prompt that says, write this in TeamSpeak, or turn this into an email, or turn this into some other format output, like a website or a blog or content like that, so that the job is not so much to write the blog, but to have the prompt set up so that anybody else can say, write a blog on this. And that's not easy, because you don't have a lot of space in the history buffer in these models. So the biggest at the moment, GPT-4, there is a 32,000 token buffer. Now, 32,000 tokens is roughly about 20,000 words. Now, that seems a lot, but if you're giving a decent context to your organization that you're working with, you could easily burn through 10,000 words giving full information about everything that needs to be placed there. And then it's got to generate its actual answer in that space as well.
Just on that, just to make sure we're clear here, when you talk about the history buffer, are you talking about the word count that you can input into the actual search bar that ChatGPT gives you?
Yeah, input plus output. So GPT 3.5, which is what people are probably more familiar with unless you're paying for the paid-for version, has a 4,000 token buffer. Now, a token, as I said, it's sort of roughly about three quarters of a word, because for words that have got like multiple different endings, like, you know, satisfaction versus satisfy, the kshn and the e, gee, that's hard to pronounce on a podcast. Normally I just write it up on a board and like
circle, a mime.
You know. So that's a token, and the satisfy is a token as well. So when you add up,
so it's breaking down into syllables, kind of thing.
It's a bit more than it's
not quite.
Strictly speaking, it's a byte pair encoded compression. But if you think of I prefer syllable. Yeah, it's not quite syllable, but it's close.
Okay, so we've got the buffer. Yep.
So you've got a buffer of text to work with, and both the input and the output has to fit into that space, because all it knows is, given the last however many thousand tokens, I want to predict what the most likely next token is. And that's all the GPT model is actually doing. So if you have like more than what GPT 3.5 can remember, so let's say you have 10,000 words of text, it just looks at a sliding window of the last 4,000 and then will generate one more word. And so if you're wanting it to generate a 2,000 word essay, by the time you've got to the end of those 2,000 words, it no longer remembers the context of what you asked it. So it gets lost. And I think you might remember somebody managed to get Bing AI to, you know, declare their, you know, permanent love for him and that sort of thing. It had just gotten lost. It had forgotten the original context of the conversation. And since the conversation was about, you know, marriage and devotion and whatever, that was all that was in the buffer of the last couple of thousand tokens. Well, that's what it kept on spitting out.
Got it. So that's the problem we've got. We've got a limited amount of space.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's firstly very interesting, because I've often wondered, you know, because it often says, you know, it's too long, you need to cut it back.
Yep.
So just on this, I know we're getting a little bit off topic there, but as a general rule, what kind of word count can we put in? Like, let's say I said, I want you to write me 1,000 words or something. How many words in the prompt can I use?
So if you're wanting 1,000 words of output, that'll probably be about 1,500 words of 1,500 tokens. So theoretical maximum would be about 2,500 tokens of input, which would be about 1,700 words input. But GPT 3.5, there's actually a little bit of a hidden pre-prompt that it has as well that we don't get access to. So that chops it down a little bit further. Also, the website itself, if you're using the API, you get more space, whereas the website, I think, limits it to about 1,000 words or thereabouts.
No, because you're wasting a lot of time, aren't you? You're putting in stuff that it's not actually going to index or register use. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're having sort of a multi-stage conversation, you can keep on going as long as you like, but remember, it won't remember what your beginning of the conversation was. You can even ask it, what is the first thing you remember? And you'll see what it was that, you know, was the last thing that's in the token buffer.
See, that's the classic example of what you're saying about the prompts, right? You do good prompts, you get, you know, garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah.
So, okay. So
now GPT-4, however, has a longer context. So the one on the website has 8,000. So that basically doubles what you've got. And they have trained up a 32,000 word model. Which is immense. You've got a lot of room there. I mean, you can drop in a small novel and have it generate like the final chapter of a novel very, very slowly. And you really wouldn't want to pay the bill from that, because I'm not sure if you've seen the pricing differences between GPT-4 and GPT-3.5, but it's a factor of 20 more expensive. So $2 to generate a really long document is, yeah, it's expensive. It's still an amazing technology to be able to do stuff, and still the productivity gains that you get from it make it worthwhile, but it's certainly not something that, you know, you just want to...
Yes.
The novel that you're writing at home, you probably don't want to have it automated completely.
That's right. And also again, we're slightly tangentialing off, which is great, but that cost factor, because I know copywriters are thinking, you know, where do I stand in all this? At some point, it will be a paid product, and a lot of people won't want to do it. They just won't need it that much, I guess, to justify it. So again, it'll be separating out people who do want to do it seriously and people who just, you know, don't really need it that much. But anyway, let's get back to the workflow, because I thought, you know, that sense of how does that change the life of a copywriter?
I'm going to try to use an analogy from computer programmers, which will probably confuse and make things much more difficult for everyone. But you don't see computer programmers writing a program and then dusting their hands off it and walking away. Every company that is writing software employs programmers for the long term, because what you're writing is, there is this code base, and you pay the programmers to essentially create patches to that code base, to make changes to it, and to apply those changes to all the different places that it makes sense to. And I think we'll see that same kind of automation happening with copywriting. Now, one of the key differences is that in programming, you can run the program autonomously and test it and see if it fails. And so there's a fast feedback loop that exists for programmers. Now, for copywriters, there isn't that same fast feedback loop. You don't write something and immediately your audience say, that was terrible. You find out like a year later that your novel has flopped, or you find out like a week later that the client thinks you've done a terrible job. But one of the interesting things with these large language models is that you can get very fast feedback. So you can get it to generate a document and then immediately ask it, evaluate that from the perspective of a... this is an example from a bank I was working with. Evaluate that from the perspective of a single parent bringing up children. Would this sound odd to them? Now, also evaluate it from the perspective of a retiree who's quite wealthy. What would they experience this letter or this email to be? So you've got this sort of feedback loop that can exist, which means that you can think in terms of, I'm not creating documents, I'm creating patches for documents. So let's say you've been doing a project with some customer and they suddenly tell you, no, actually, we didn't start this product in 2005. We actually have been developing it since 1996. Now, in the current workflow, you would then have to go back and edit every document and generate a new version of every document. So all the copy that you've written for all the different sort of contexts, all the different target audiences, you'd go and change that by hand. In the new world, that would be just part of workflow automation. You would, you know, say, okay, ChatGPT, go back through all these prompts and correct all these prompts so that no longer references a 2005 start, it references a 1996 start, or whatever the date actually was. So it's going to be a different style of writing. If you sort of imagine you have a wall filled with hundreds of pieces of paper and you make one small change and instantly every document on every wall is updated according to the changes that you have made, that's what a workflow in, say, 2025 to 2028 is probably going to look like for a copywriter. Very, very different. But I think probably very engaging and powerful, because suddenly you're not just writing a little bit, you're writing a lot.
And in terms of the needs of the client, you know, can you maybe just speak to what that relationship could be like even versus the programmer that you just mentioned and their client. So, what would the future of that copywriter's sort of relationship look like?
Well, funnily enough, like in the wave model that I mentioned, like adjacency and volume is going to be significant. So obviously volume is going to be dramatically higher. So large companies or even smaller companies are now in a position where they could reasonably ask their copywriter to produce many, many drafts of the same kind of document in lots of different ways. Which, if you're not using these GPT-like technologies, will just be incredibly onerous. So just sort of to throw some linguistic examples out. If you don't mind us getting distracted, let's talk about English linguistics. Now, English is it's described as what happens when you take a language into a side street and do terrible things to it. So we simultaneously have three different languages that we're speaking at the same time. So there's the language of the French, who of course conquered England in 1066 and then dominated discourse for the next sort of maybe 500 years would be a fair estimate, plus the influence of the Latinate scholars. So we have all this high-class language that has Romance language linguistic roots. So anytime you're seeing like a word that ends in an E, you know that it's coming from that space, and it's generally going to be something, it's the high-class version of it. It's the academic version. So let's commence the proceedings of... I'm just trying to think of a romance way of saying podcast. This, perhaps the audio experience. Then we have a second language, which is the Germanic language, and that ultimately comes from the Viking invasions and the taking over of Kent and things like that. And so there's particularly commerce. We tend to use Germanic language. So we'll begin whatever it is that we're doing. So instead of to begin is to, it's the same as to commence, but we use it in a different context. Then the third is the Saxon language. So the language of the people who were indigenous to the United Kingdom before they got invaded by the Germans and the Swedes and the French and everybody else who had a turn on them. And we use this in much more colloquial speech. So let's start. And it's very simple. So you can see how a company might well want to do A-B testing of different language, different target audiences, different styles with every document they generate. So you can just take one of your existing pieces of work, throw it in ChatGPT and say, rewrite this using Romance language. And just to clarify it, you probably want to tell it, Latin-based language, and see what it produces. And it'll produce this very nice formalized document that you can present to a client and they would use in formal contexts and would sound very scientific and upright. And some companies who are trying to present that kind of image will be very, very happy with that. Some companies don't realize that's the image they're presenting, and they'll suddenly find that their audiences resonate with that language far more than when you also generate the Germanic-based one or the Anglo-Saxon-based version. And there's all sorts of variations on this, like ask it to write in teen speak, ask it to write in, just trying to think of a few examples, maybe African-American English, if you happen to be working overseas. It's a very different style. These are all these little sub-niches of linguistic endeavor that you could reasonably be expected to produce documents in. Produce many documents. Produce enough so that their marketing team, when they are sending an email out, can split their audience in half and send 50% of them, say, the high-class romance language and 50% of them the casual Anglo-Saxon style, and see which gets the better uptake. This applies for advertising, it applies for mail outs, it applies for blogs, it applies, you know, wherever you can divvy up an audience, you can learn a lot about an audience by generating multiple versions of the same copy.
I think what's interesting there, Greg, is traditionally A/B testing has been you just change one variable at a time. You know, you change the headline, you change the offer, you might change the PS, for example. You know, that's sort of the traditional approach. But what you're saying here is you can change the entire essence of a piece and the voice, which you generally, you know, it's not done, but it's not generally done because it's too hard to pick what actually was changed, you know, what was different here. And that just lends itself to amazing insights. And the audience may not even understand what they've resonated with, you know, because it's not one thing. It's the feeling.
Yeah. But it was probably generated from one sentence. So what are we A/B testing? We're A/B testing one sentence of the prompt. Output this as teen speak. Output this in formal language. That's what we're A/B testing. But the downstream impact of that is much more sophisticated than we've just changed a PS or we've just changed a subject line.
Interesting. So this is now the A of the wave.
Well, actually more the V, the adjacencies. The A is kind of interesting as well. So obviously you've got the adjacency in the sense that you can move up into sort of the marketing space and be providing a lot more value to marketing than previously you would. But there's also at least, I see two other places where copywriting just sort of will be able to have a really outsized impact and will actually change another industry more than copywriting itself. And the first one's kind of obvious, and that's graphic artists. Because graphic artists at the moment, they get out their Photoshop and they do some editing. But we've already seen for nearly a year now, DALL-E can do a pretty good job. Stable Diffusion can do a pretty good job. And they're improving fast. There are major ethical problems here about stealing of people's work and people's work being, copywritten work being used as part of prompts. But one way or another, these things are going to be solved. And somebody who can write a really good prompt to generate an image, well, it's not that different to writing a really good prompt to generate blog copy or to generate a good email. So I think we'll find that a lot of people who might be listening on this podcast will find themselves generating all sorts of things, images, diagrams, pictures, backgrounds that they might never otherwise have thought of doing because, you know, you and I aren't artists. We can't, like, if I can't even draw a picture of a cat reliably, but I can generate a prompt of a cat riding on a surfboard in outer space or whatever we might do there. That might be the picture for the podcast episode.
That's interesting because what you're saying here is you are a mini marketing agency in yourself, you know, and you don't need those, you know, 3 years at graphic design school to know how to use Photoshop, which is, you know, infinitely, you know, more complicated than, you know, rewriting something in some respects.
You realize that the people who study Photoshop find it much easier than writing a long sentence.
Yes, yeah. I guess I'm being.
Yeah.
And just to sort of biases to it, yeah.
Yeah, and likewise, programmers. So computer programming is probably being transformed faster than anything else, obviously because programmers are, you know, not afraid of using computers for all sorts of interesting things. But the speed at which you can generate programs now is just stunning. The startup that I've been launching, I've barely written a line of code myself. I've just generated a whole bunch of prompts and made it generate the code for me. And that's going to have a couple of really interesting impacts. So one is, are you a good copywriter who's able to really precisely nail down exactly what something should do or how it should be? Well, you're probably going to find that you could just put those prompts into a GPT-like model and generate a working program. And that's going to tie back into that sort of changing of workflow. If you're on Windows, you've probably never used a thing called PowerShell. Because it's for power users. And if you love playing with words, you're probably not interested in learning the technology behind, you know, power automation. But you don't have to learn that now. If you can precisely define what you're wanting to do, you could probably ask ChatGPT to write a PowerShell script to do it. So you need to, you know, update the maybe do a search and replace for 2005 in all your Word documents in a folder. Now, that would be a really tedious task if you've got 100 Word documents. You're not going to do that by hand. But you could ask GPT to write a PowerShell script that will open each Word document in turn, launch the search button, search for 2005, replace it by 1996, save the document, close it, and exit. Perfectly normal thing to automate.
Yeah, this is getting really interesting now, because what you're saying, and I'm not a programmer, as you well know, but what you're saying, I'm just getting my head around this, is you don't just use the ChatGPT website, you actually write the code, then you apply it to your own documents in your own folders, which enables you to become this programmer slash copywriter exponential.
There's a whole bunch of different things you can do. So you could just go to ChatGPT on the website and say, write me a PowerShell script to do this task that I have to do. And it will generate a nice, pretty looking program, which you then copy and paste into PowerShell and run it. And
what,
then,
what is PowerShell, Greg? I missed that.
So PowerShell is a lovely technology that's on Windows that lets you automate almost any activity.
Got it.
There's another program called AutoHotkey, which is also very famous. Again, the reason that these are niche technologies is because you have to learn to program in order to use them. But now that everybody has the ability to program, just describe what you want to do and have ChatGPT generate the program for you, it becomes a lot easier. On Mac, the equivalent is a program called Automator. And it too has a unique programming language, which you can tell GPT to generate for you. And it can do things like, you know, open a document, search, find, print, close it, copy it, email it, populate the file name into a spreadsheet so that you can send a spreadsheet of all the things that you've got available to a customer. This is the kind of, oh my gosh, we can suddenly automate a whole bunch of stuff that was just tedious overhead task. And of course, there's going to be expectations on copywriters to be much more productive, because everybody else in the economy is being that much more productive as well.
That's really mind-blowing. I hadn't even thought about it from that perspective, and I don't think other people had. And this was stemmed from the conversation about the graphic artist.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can become a mini advertising agency and generate a lot of content this way.
You can build your own website. That's pretty straightforward, including dynamic elements. And
just talk me through that, because I know every copywriter wants to build a website and pulls their hair out at the process. So what's the steps in that?
Well, you're a copywriter. What do you want to say on the website? So copy and paste that into, you know, ChatGPT window and say, please generate a nicely formatted HTML page for this website, including style sheets that are suitable for a small business copywriting business. And it'll produce some HTML for you, and it'll say something along the lines of, well, you'll need a hosting provider for that. So you'll ask, what's a hosting provider? What's a suggestion of a hosting provider? And it'll probably suggest like Dreamhost or Amazon, and then walk you through the ask it to walk you through the process of uploading that website and walk you through the process of organizing the domain name. And, you know, if you want to get really fancy, you could ask it, please create a Terraform script to automatically register the domain name, register the web servers, and upload the content. That's probably a bit sophisticated, because anything that goes wrong there is going to blow up very badly in very strange ways. But yeah, you can just walk your way through that kind of thing very easily.
Oh, that's so cool. Okay,
You have at your fingertips, essentially, one of the most educated individuals in the world. This is ChatGPT that can get a B+ in an MBA exam, can answer questions on economics, can coherently write in the style of Shakespeare. You have the most wonderful personalized tutor that you could ever hope for.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've done the W, we've done the A. Was there anything more on the A that we needed to cover? Adjacencies?
No, I think that's pretty much it. Yeah. I can think of.
Yeah. So pretty much what you're saying on the A is what we're just saying, which is there's this adjacent industries and sectors and services that you can become adept at because of the power of this tool.
Yes, because you're good at writing words. One of the funny memes that was going around for many computer programmers was, you know, there's always discussions about what's the hot new programming language that you need to learn. Like, you know, C# was, you know, the hot language for a while, and then Python and a bunch of other things like that. And so the meme was the hot new programming language, English.
Why is that? Just I know the obvious answer, but I'm interested in your answer. Why is that?
Why is English the hot new?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's quite correct, because I've happily chatted with ChatGPT in Chinese and French and German. It's not actually English only. You know, you can ask it in Farsi to write a program for you, which I actually saw happen a few weeks ago. I think the most fun part about that was watching this this poor woman who'd been struggling with English, trying to express what she wanted to do, and I said, "Well, just type in Farsi," and
yeah,
out came a program. So
amazing. So I guess also what you're saying there is our ability as writers is now a superpower in some respects.
Yeah, it is.
Because we've got the opportunity to write really well, really clearly, and using the briefs, you know, the creative briefs that I talk about in my courses, and understanding how to drag it out of the client, what they want, the target audience, the features, benefits. So if you're good at getting this kind of raw material correct and the strategy right, then the ChatGPT is just your fast tracker kind of processor.
And also at a very low level technical level, you're probably less likely to make spelling or grammar mistakes. You're probably very careful in the way you write things to make sure that they're not ambiguous and that they are understood. And those are factors that make a huge difference to the quality of the outputs. One little typo on an important word can mean that it just misses that's what you're talking about.
I was also thinking, to be a good copywriter, you need to know what's good. And that sense of discernment and discrimination is integral, right? Because what chat gives you is not necessarily good. It's interesting, it's fast, it's all those kinds of things, and it's pretty good, but it may not be appropriate for the task at hand. And I think that's where copywriters do have a role to play too, is to say, you know, well, out of everything you've given me, I'm going to change this, this, and this, because it needs to do a certain task.
Yeah. I think you should probably change the job title to copy reader, because you'll do a lot of reading of text and identify that actually paragraph two is pretty bad. And even if your response to paragraph two is pretty bad is ChatGPT, you need to update paragraph two and make it funnier, or use an analogy from brain surgery as to, you know, why peeling a banana is like brain surgery or something. Even if you have to do that rather than rewrite it by hand, ultimately the reason you did that is because you were able to read it and you were able to identify this was the thing that needed to be changed.
And probably part two is copy editor. I think that's the editing function, which we do anyway, naturally. That's the nature of a copywriter's role, is to review and to rewrite. But I think the editing has probably become as important as the original draft.
Yeah, but sub-editing is now a whole lot simpler. It's really simple. Just grab the whole text and pop it in and say, you know, identify any spelling mistakes or grammar mistakes in this, and get a short summary. Oh, yep, you're right. I did typo that word, or I did misspell this, or, you know.
Interesting. So let's go. We talked about the V a little bit. Maybe we'll just touch back on the WAV. What's the V again?
The volume, the sheer volume of the productivity that we are now going to have. In every one of these technological improvements, what it's corresponded to is an increase in the output of copywriters, or going back far enough, increase the output from scribes, increase the output from ticket writers, increase the output from whatever the job title was in that at that particular time in history. Now, that leads into the last bit, which is the entrepreneurship part. And you see this at every phase through this sort of historical change. And if we just sort of put on our Marxist hat and say, well, you know, the factors of production, funnily enough, Marx didn't actually write this at all. It's what we in the 20th century then put back as saying this is what Marx was actually meaning, that the factors of production are labor. You need people to actually do some work. Land, because you know, you've got to grow stuff or you've got to dig stuff up or something like that. Capital has got to be money for the tools for the workers to do things productively. You know, in his case, of course, he was thinking about machines from the Industrial Revolution. We now tend to add two more onto that. We tend to add management expertise and entrepreneurship, the idea that it's not good enough just to have workers going and doing things. You have to have some sort of management over it, that work, so that people actually work on the right things and that there's a sort of a coherent target of what we build. So just going through those again, we're going to have this massive increase in the productivity of all white-collar workers. So not just copywriters, but as I said before, programmers are suddenly dramatically faster. Graphic artists will be faster if they're not actually squashed out altogether. Lawyers will be faster. You name it. Find a white-collar job that's not going to be sped up dramatically by the existence of these large language models. So labor is now dramatically more productive, which means in terms of the factors of production, there's going to be dramatic demand on land, capital, management expertise, entrepreneurship. Let me say that in another way that really startles people. If you believe that this is going to double our productivity, and I think that's a very reasonable thing to believe, then you're essentially saying that the cost of land, the interest rates on money, the payment for good managers and the rewards to entrepreneurs are all going to double. And, you know, if you're an Australian audience and you're hearing that land prices are going to double and interest rates are going to double, I'm not saying they'll both double, but in some aggregate way, these are going to, you know, increase in value by a factor of two across all these different areas. That's a startling statement. So it means if you're thinking of launching your own entrepreneurial business right now, you can expect the rewards from that to be a good multiple higher than any other time in the recent past. So in the same way that we saw a huge amount of investment in the dot-com boom for technology, now we're going to see the same kind of thing broadly over the whole white-collar space. So this will be an amazing time to launch a copywriting, I don't know, service, commit to a customer. For a fixed fee, I will make sure that all your websites are up to date with relevant and useful information. I'll make sure that you've got an A/B test happening every week. I'll write some very large number of your emails and so on and so on. This is the time to launch that business because the rewards are so high and because the cost of doing things in that white collar space of writing documents has suddenly dropped down very rapidly.
Interesting. So in terms of the why, I guess, could you maybe just go into the why it will double? I know you probably said that, but I just need a little bit of a reminder as to why it's doubling, just in a lay person's terms.
Well, if you're saying that our productivity is going to double, in white collar productivity is going to double, then all the other factors of production have to keep up. All the other factors in aggregate are going to have to double. So it might mean that something does more than double and something does less than double. Like, I hope it's not land prices double. What would be ideal is the rewards to entrepreneurs suddenly go enormously sky high while land and capital and management expertise stay about the same. And I guess that really depends on how entrepreneurial your audience is, really.
Yeah. So what you're saying, so I really want to get this right, is because we're more productive and we're smarter about the way we do it and we can offer quite an amazing breadth of service that is quite labor intensive, but it's been automated, yep, it means that the client is finding it incredibly valuable and they could probably do it if they were in that kind of business, but they're not. They're actually in a completely different separate business, so they're not going to invest in that kind of knowledge and time and effort to make it happen. But if we as copywriters go, you know, this, I'm going to double down on this. I'm going to get really good at chat. I'm going to know how to build a website using chat. I'm going to use all those automatic prompts and automations to update documents quite quickly, then I can become super valuable to any business and I can charge double, triple, whatever it is. Is that kind of what we're saying?
Yep. Clayton Christensen's arguments about what does a disruptive business look like? It's when there are existing companies out there that only offer X and Y. But if you can find a way of delivering X without having to deliver Y, then you're instantly cheaper and you're actually trying to solve the real problem the customer's having. So if the real problem the customer is having is I need to have more information about my customers, which I want to get by pushing out more, you know, output and seeing the responses at a faster rate. And if your response to that is, I can do that. I've automated almost everything. You don't need an army of employees to do this. You have a very disruptive business there.
Love it. And the other spin on that in terms of disruption, another definition of it, is when you have, and it's kind of what you said, but different, you have one sector over here, let's call it copywriting, and you have one sector over here called programming, completely different sectors. But when you merge them and mash them up and you create those synergies, that's a new industry.
Yeah, it is. And the people who dominate that are going to do very, very well.
Yeah, that's really eye-opening, I think, and enlightening for me just to hear this, because I've been, you know, sort of around the entrepreneurial sector for a while, and I've always looked at, you know, what are the disruptors? And it's when these two disparate kind of sectors merge that don't normally, you wouldn't put them together. After this conversation, I mean, before this conversation, Greg, I would never have put programming and copywriting together ever.
No, they're different universes.
Yeah.
You do your English literature studies at university and then go into a copywriting career, and I do mathematics and applied physics and ended up in computing. Like, we had nothing in common, and yet hopefully this afternoon you'll have played around with Automator or PowerShell or something like that. And meanwhile, I'm generating vast amounts of documents for courseware. It's and translations of books and things like that.
Yeah. Well, just on that, Greg, let's just, as we wrap up, let's talk about a few of the developments or inventions that you've come up with that, you know, you find interesting and you're passionate about, like the genius of crowds. That sounds interesting.
Okay. Let me explain where that's coming from. So there's the Babel theory of leadership, and it's rather cynical, but it's actually has a lot of experimental evidence, which is, let's say you've got an organization and maybe it's a charity or maybe it is a company, but the leadership structures aren't really in place yet. Maybe there's been a lot of change and churn. And so there's informal and formal leadership roles. Now, how do people get appointed leader of a group? And we'd like to believe that we use sort of reasonable criteria for doing so, like, you know, we choose our leaders because they have good insight or they're really smart or something like that. Well, the truth is, it's nothing like that. The factors that predict whether somebody's going to be a leader is things like how tall they are, how attractive they are. And the Babel theory of leadership shows that one of the really big factors is how much the person talks. And it doesn't actually matter what they talk about, whether it's complete and utter rubbish or whether it is actually coherent or not. The more you talk, the more people think of you as the leader. Now, this, you can sort of see a certain logic as to how we've ended up in our society doing that, because if I can just ask you to stand up and give a 10-minute impromptu speech about absolutely nothing and you rabbit on, perhaps coherently, but not saying anything of import, you obviously have very high verbal intelligence. And if you've got very high verbal intelligence, then I can probably assume that you've probably got other aspects of intelligence. And so if I had to choose between somebody who gets up on a podium and can say three words before sitting down, or somebody who can stand up and say 10,000 words before sitting down, obviously I'll go with the person who speaks the 10,000 words because they seem to be coherent. And so the Babel theory of leadership says these are the people who get appointed as our leaders. And so we see in this sort of current generation, we get, you know, this CEO is really good because, like, they're very coherent and they talk well and they present on television really well. Great leader. Nowhere in this does it actually talk about whether they're competent or not. Now, the big problem with this leadership appointing in an era of GPT is that if you want me to give you a 10,000 word narrative on why this is the, I don't know, the very best podcast in all the world, I can generate that for you. If you want me to generate a podcast that's a 10,000 word essay as to why this is the very worst podcast in the world, GPT will oblige with that as well. So your ability to generate large amounts of words and to be able to say a lot of stuff is now not predictive of your verbal intelligence. So what we're going to see is over the next 5 years in particular, a lot of people getting into managerial roles who really can't do the job. And also there's going to be a lot of people who have already been in sort of managerial roles who can talk but can't actually make decisions or don't really know how to respond to a world where white-collar work has suddenly become twice as productive and all the rules of how we establish our businesses have fallen apart. So it's a very, very interesting time in that at the time that we're going to see massive change in what we do, our leadership structures are going to be completely inappropriate for it. So that's the context of it. Now, there's a very interesting economist called Robin Hanson, and he comes up with the craziest possible ideas, but every single one of them, you walk away going, that's so crazy, and then you realize about a day later that it's brilliant. So impact certificates is a wonderful new way of creating donations to charity that are investable. Futarchy, which is the idea that politicians should establish what they want to have as their metrics, but not to actually establish policies because the policies can be set up by a market. Very, very interesting ones. And so my response to this is one of the ideas that Robin Hanson has particularly promoted is the idea of prediction markets. So let's say you're wanting to decide some big strategic decision in your company. Like, should we expand into Singapore or should we expand into the Philippines? Now, people in aggregate are much smarter than any machine learning algorithm, and they're much smarter than any expert. It's kind of unexpected that in an organization, you should be asking the cleaner and the CEO to simultaneously say what's going to happen in the future, because they all have some little aspect to understand how things work. So you'd set up a prediction market. You set up a market that says, if we go into expand into Singapore, how much will our revenue be? And if we're going to expand into Indonesia, how much is our revenue going to be? And people who are who get the answer most closely correct, we're going to give you a cash reward out of a prize pool that we establish. So if you correctly predict, you know, the revenue next year in the expansion into Singapore, you might get, say, $5,000, which is a very nice bonus, which is very aligned to you did something really good for the organization, so we're going to reward you for providing valuable information here. But at the same time, that everybody in the organization is incentivized to then give the best information that they can because they want to make as much money as they can out of this market. At an executive leadership level, you've now received full information from the whole organization about what the whole organization thinks is going to be the difficulties ahead and what will succeed and what won't. If you see that the average prediction for Singapore is, you know, revenue is going to be $1 million and the revenue for Indonesia is, sorry, did I say Indonesia or Philippines?
Philippines.
I think the average prediction is $500,000 in the Philippines. You've just made a decision really easily. Everybody agrees that it's going to be, you know, Singapore is the way to go. And what we've found in the clients I've worked with so far is it works. The aggregate decisions are far more accurate than any individual. So like if you were working in a sales organization, you ask the head of sales what sales will be, they come with their own biases. But if you ask the whole organization, you're spot on every single time. And so it's an amazing way to give you strategic decision-making and to engage employees. So if any of your listeners are actually working in an organization and you want to have your voice heard, it's a great way of being able to contribute something really useful to both the management and the culture of the company.
And I imagine the managerial sector would be quite keen on this because it kind of decentralizes their decision making and distances them a little from having to be the oracle of truth. They're saying, look, I'm taking into everyone's opinion here. So it's a fascinating concept, Greg. And you've got some software around this.
Yes. So I've got a website, geniusofcrowds.com, that successfully does this.
Okay. So if people want to know more about that, they go to geniusofcrowds.com.
Yep.
And is there any way they can also get in touch with you, or how would you like to connect with anybody here?
Do we provide like an email address in the...
Email's great.
Okay. So gregb@ifos.org.au or gregb@geniusofcrowds.com.
Sounds like an amazing tool. I love the topic too, Genius of Crowds, Listeners of Crowds. It's brilliant. Greg, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you today. You're one of the most educated and most across so many different topics. And I think that's what makes your you know, pronouncements quite interesting, because it's not just from a computer programming point of view. It's about art, it's history, it's language, you know, it is maths, it's AI. I mean, it's an amazing cornucopia of content to draw from. So thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
As you can see, Greg has his finger on the pulse of where this exciting technology is going. And like all advances in technology, it's those who take it on, who embrace it and use it, who gain from it. We don't really know where it's going to take us right now, but step aboard the train, see where the journey takes you, and enjoy the ride. If you want to find out how other copywriters are accessing this kind of technology and want live tutorials on how you can use it in your copywriting business, join our community at copyclub.com.au. We know that the fastest way to keep abreast of new technology is to surround yourself with people who are using this technology and know where it's going. That's what Copy Club can do for you. Don't get left behind. Join the community who can take you to new heights and help your copywriting business grow. As always, I finish with a joke, and I use that word loosely. What do you call a writer who doesn't follow the rules of sentence structure? A rebel without a clause. And of course, my motivational quote to leave you with, don't wish it was easier, wish you were better. A little harsh, thank you, Jim Rohn, but nonetheless, I think you get the gist. Well, that's it from me. All the best and bye-bye.
This podcast was brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre. Do you want to create a point of difference with your copywriting, charge more for your services, and keep ahead of industry trends? Have a look at our course, SEO Copywriting. Created by Bernadette Schwert, this 5-week online course will teach you how to write copy that Google loves. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/SEO. And thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Copywriter. You'll find the show notes at soyouwanttobeacopywriter.com.au.